Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound.
On the show this week, we'll be talking craft and how to sell down-home charm to the rest of the world. Annie Warburton from the Crafts Council and the artist Phoebe Cummings will be telling us why they're taking British craft to Miami to do just that.
We'll also be speaking to Paddy Butler, who runs one of London's best bookshops, Libraria, about why their upcoming event is looking at the darker side of literature, celebrating reads that will keep you up all night.
I will be speaking to Jose Pizarro, the chef and restaurateur, whose new book takes in the varied flavours of Catalonia.
All that plus Tom Edwards, oh yes, he's going to be back with the news look ahead, and we're going to hear some new music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Here we are, Andrew, in the midst of another busy week at Monocle HQ. What's been your favourite bit of the week?
Yesterday was the first day of the Monocle Christmas Market, and it's carrying on all day today as well.
Yeah, so actually, that's why you're smiling.
If you come down, you can just nip out the front door, and we've got a couple of reindeer at this very moment. That's been good. And
we've got a tombola full of bursting full of amazing prizes.
Yes.
Metaphorically speaking.
Yes.
We've got a Santa.
So that's all been amazing. And then during the week, we have been slightly busy. We're doing the winter newspapers as we did in the summer. So there's going to be four of those. There's a forecast issue coming out. There's lots of radio. We're plotting and planning for our Christmas party, our own Christmas party. We're flying in all our teams from around the world in a couple of weeks' time.
When all this stuff happens, much of it, almost all of it, in fact, under your stewardship, all things apart from the Christmas fair, when you think about the Christmas party, how many drinks do you think you'll have before you have anything to eat? Just in terms of, I don't know, letting off steam. I mean, this is what it's for. It's a great team. It's a great bonding exercise the influence of party vibes, let's say.
I'd like to claim,
Andrew,
that after all these years, I have a good handbrake that controls my... Yeah, but no, I'm sure I'll be like...
Okay, we'll move it on.
Well, because we have the one and only Tom Edwards with the news look ahead.
Hello, everybody. So you may have, I don't know, can I confess that I guffawed in the background a moment ago? Is that acceptable?
It's all right, I think it's good. I think we'll
involuntary leave
it.
Guffawing.
Yeah, that's all right. It's good.
And can I also just say, I've been browsing Jose Pizarro's book. I know you're going to be speaking to him a bit later.
Mm.
I opened it at random on this page of marinated grilled squid. So we might have to wrap this up quick. I need to go and get some food.
The food, well, we'll be talking to him. The food looks amazing.
Lavish,
yeah.
Doesn't it? Well, it's funny. I mean, this all does tie up, really, because on Tuesday, official campaigning begins for the Catalan elections. And obviously, that's what Jose's book is all about. And it's been in the news.
It's not about the Catalan elections.
No. It's about Catalonia. Given the whole independent schism, whatever you want to call it, it'll be really interesting to see what kind of tone people strike. What's the rhetoric? How aggressive can people be? How nationalistic? Or how conciliatory? You know, for the whole of Spain, are people going to try and broaden out the message and speak some more universal truth? So I just think it'll be a really interesting thing. And I always find it funny to roll out a big season of political campaigning, just a few days before Christmas. But
yeah, mostly people are thinking of El Gordo,
exactly,
in Spain at this time of year, aren't
but
they?
The actual election, I think, happens on the 21st. So pretty extraordinary. But yeah, interesting. And I don't know, maybe Jose will talk a little bit about some tempestuous times in his motherland a little later.
And I'm not going to dive into that. I will just say that
in
the forecast issue coming up, we have a really good diary of the last year in Catalan politics, which just kind of unpicks all of the stages that you go through to get to one of those tempestuous historical moments. And I didn't write it or commission it. I can say so. It's a rollicking read. So have a good look at that too.
There you go. Rob, I guess one more, a little bit more with your cultural hat on. The Turner Prize, I gather. Is that on Tuesday,
Tuesday
is awarded.
Tuesday night, yeah.
Always quite interesting. You had Assemble, sort of collective, who won last time. And I kind of like this because it seems to upset as many people as it delights every year for one reason or another. So always interesting to see what the panel of various illustrious cultural figures, where they alight. And I think it has a bit of impact even without the UK.
Is this the winner announced or the nominees?
It's the big ceremony at Tate Britain.
So I think it'd be an interesting one. It is a sort of, you know, it's one of those things. Does it still have the same clout? Does it annoy people as much as it seemed to be the point of it was in the 1990s? And does it make any difference to an artist's career? These are all sort of quite interesting things. At the moment, I guess it's something that's quite good quality that's just sort of bedded in, right? But I think the TV coverage of it tries to boost it up, obviously. There's a bit of boosterism. I think Goldie is presenting this year's award.
There we go. Worth probably keeping an eye on just to see what he might do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he's a fairly...
one of our favourite, rather unpredictable characters.
Exactly.
You mentioned, Andrew, the Monocle Christmas Market in full swing about the place. Santa's jetted in. Hundreds of skiing Santas will hit the slopes on Tuesday in Maine, in Newry. That's a sight to behold if you're knocking around in Maine.
Yeah.
I quite like it in London where they have a Santa kind of flash mob.
Well, I was going to say, the SantaCon, the same day. More than 1,000 Santas, as everyone knows, kids. There's only one. And they absolutely carouse through the streets of London.
No, I was going to say, because I saw them, I've seen bumped into them twice in the last couple of years. And last year, there were quite a few Larry Santas going around.
Well, he does take on drink, as I understand
it. Yeah, I think it starts off quite jolly with all like family vibe. But by like 7 o'clock, they were hammered, those Santas.
Well, if you want to see them in action, shortly before sunset, Google it to work out exactly when it is, there'll be some sort of carol singing carry-on occurring, you know, on the Lions in Trafalgar Square.
Yeah.
Often the scene of revelry when drink is taken. They'll be doing something there, so head on over.
Will do.
Or avoid the area, depending where you're coming from. A couple of rather stupid things. World Memory Championships. Are you familiar with this? It's taking place in Shenzhen in China. More than 100 people from 26 countries taking part over a number of days. And it's basically precisely what it says. You have to memorise all sorts of things. Sequences of cards, numbers, pi to the infinitesimal degree. And all these people who one can only presume have spent the last year, maybe years, training themselves for what is ultimately one of, to my mind, the great pointless... undertakings. Let's move on. One last one. A bit more cultural sustenance for you, Rob. On Saturday in Los Angeles, Julian's Auctions in LA are holding a big sort of closing event of the season. And they're selling loads of stuff from Neil Young.
Oh,
loads
man.
Of stuff from his archive. All sorts. So, okay.
This is up your street, Tom.
Very much so. If there's any... you know, wealthy listeners out there, do feel free to buy some stuff and send it to me. And there's vintage recording gear and old tour amps and guitars and all
I just kind of like anything with his handwriting. He's got such good handwriting. You know, a lot of his album covers, he draws himself and he's got that wonderful, odd handwriting.
Well, can you imagine?
I'd love something in his handwriting.
Esoteric there'd be. Yeah. And of course, there's all things like loads of his model. You know, he's a massive model train enthusiast. If you read his autobiography, which is madcap tilts from one subject to another, probably the lion's share of it is about model railways and like weird technology and the future of automobiles and this kind of thing. But Lionel model trains, some of his classic cars, clothes, all sorts, lots of it just for the first time. So
I'd quite like the high top Nike trainers that he wore what is it? Ragged Glory.
Yeah.
That kind of outfit. The Ray-Bans, long hair.
There you go, listeners.
That's pretty good
Christmas
outfit.
Card lists. Strike them off left and right.
Let's do it.
But yeah, dust your wallets off and get down to the Julian's.
Dust never sleeps.
Dust never sleeps. Bang! Love it.
Well, thank you, Tom. Thank you so much. That was a very good news.
Tom's burning out. He's not fading away. See you, Tom.
We're looking at craft this week on the Monocle Weekly. We're now all fairly familiar with the resurgence of makers and doers helping shape some of the design world's most prominent trends. But how do you effectively communicate the sheer breadth of talent in the world of craft? Well, and how do you do this on a global scale too?
Here to tell us is Annie Warburton, Creative Director of the Crafts Council in the UK, and Phoebe Cummings, a ceramic artist whose intricate clay works recently won her the Women's Hour Craft Prize, and who'll be part of a delegation led by Annie of some of the best British makers attending the upcoming Form Fair in Miami as part of the showcase A Future Made. Welcome both to the Monocle Weekly. Let's tackle the Miami question first, you know, because this is a good boat to be sailing on. I know that sort of craft is becoming more part of the design Miami part of it and all the rest of it. Are you pushing against an open door, Annie, with taking British makers and some of this kind of the cusp on which design and art meet to Miami?
Yeah, I would like to think it's an open door. I think if you look at Frieze Art Fair this year, or indeed last year, for example, you see a resurgence in artists using ceramics and also textiles in particular. Certainly last year when we took a bunch of makers to Design Miami Basel, we were really the first to show and put a spotlight on craft in that scenario. We took some makers out last year to Miami and it caused a bit of a stir.
Do people need to always be told what that is? Do people need to know whether they're talking about artists or kind of industrial designers or more of the traditional idea of what we think of craft?
Oh, look, you've got it. The boundaries are really, really blurry. You have makers operating in a fine art context. You've got Grayson Perry or Edmond Duval, of course. Yeah. Then you've got makers working in industrial design and informing that. Product design, everyday products. And then, you know, pure craft. I don't think we need to get too strict about those definitions. If you look at other countries' practice like Korea or Japan, it's all just making. It's all just making as part of art.
Now, Phoebe, I hinted here that unfortunately you're not going, but your work is. Mm-hmm. Now, when I was looking at your work this afternoon, what's interesting is lots of it you designed deliberately to not be permanent. So you use unfired clay, and you've done works before that have been deliberately designed to wash away in the process of them being shown. What are you sending to this world of the big collectors that may be going to stick around for a bit more than a few hours?
So I guess generally my work's kind of a bit problematic in terms of collecting, because generally it's made to only last very briefly. So actually the work that I'm sending is kind of the residue, I guess, of a piece that I made last year. So it's a photograph of a work that I made and then a group of fragments from that piece. So they're small kind of fired parts that have come from the installation, but it's really, I guess, a document of the original artwork that I'll be showing there.
Now, this is an amazing show for art and design, but as we were hinting there, it has become the nexus for people who have a lot of money to spend and who want to buy permanent works. And we were referencing there Edmond Duval and Grayson Perry, two ceramicists who are at the top of their game, I think charging reasonable amounts for what they do these days. Is that something that you deliberately don't want to get involved in, that commercial side, or are you on a bit of an artistic process that may one day end up with you doing gallery works for permanent collections? What's the tension between being true to this thing you've found and knowing as a designer, as a craftsperson, you need to feed yourself at the end of the month as well?
Yeah. Initially, I think the drive for the work is always kind of coming from trying to learn something and interest in the materials, and that's always kind of come first and is how I began working in that way. And then that's tended to lead more to working in public galleries and museums, because obviously there isn't always an obvious product at the end of what I make. It's in some ways much closer to performance. They're not solid things usually. So
then maybe the photography of the event becomes the artwork that gives it some permanence and makes you part of a collection, for example.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the point where potentially there is something physical to collect from it, because usually the initial artwork is very much about the moment and how that's experienced, although I always kind of document it in usually photographs and film. And then only more recently, I've started to also save some material fragments as well. And I kind of see that all of that material really as part of a whole to kind of describe the original work. So I don't really always think of the photographs as necessarily a new artwork. It's more a kind of document of the original artwork, I think.
It's interesting stuff, because we often hear that we can judge the robustness of the art market and maybe by extension the design and craft market by how conceptual things are. So when times are tough, people want, you know, painting of a boat to put over their fireplace, right? But when people are feeling a little bit more free and easy and freewheeling, then conceptual things can be appreciated a little bit more easily. Do we sense, this is a question for both of you, Annie, this is something you can answer first. Mm. Do we sense a robustness about the new understanding of what craft can be by work such as Phoebe's and putting it on the plane and taking it to Miami?
Absolutely. I think people are waking up to the idea that craft can explore concepts just as much as any other fine art practice. And you see that in ceramics with the work of people like Jesse Wine, of course Phoebe, people like Neil Brownsword as well, another ceramicist. And so I would say that that's highly robust, and people are shifting their perception from craft simply being about homeware and domestic objects, it can still be that, to something through which ideas can be explored and communicated.
And the idea, and also, sorry, I'm just going to say, the idea of the process of making something perfect. A lot of people are very interested in the imperfections that went along the way, right? There is a great thing, whether you're speaking about craft or speaking about art, of visiting the artists in their studio and seeing some of the things that they think they messed up and you think you'd quite like to buy.
Yeah.
Or steal. But there is something about that, right? Showing your working is a wonderful thing to be able to do, especially in a gallery context, right?
Yeah, people are fascinated with process. Phoebe was talking about documenting through film the actual finished work, although Phoebe's work is durational as well. But we've run for a couple of years now a film festival as part of London Craft Week, which does just that. It reveals the behind-the-scenes stories of making, sometimes in very unexpected ways.
And Phoebe, you know, again, going back to these references of these now celebrated ceramicists around you, of a generation, of a time more than a generation, do you feel any connection with them, or is it us outsiders linking, you know, clay and pottery, thinking you've all got something in common? Do you feel as disparate from, you know, the likes of an Edmond Duval, or do you feel that there is a moment of kind of slightly revolutionary new ideas coming through in the ceramics world?
I mean, I think ceramics and what that might kind of encompass has certainly changed a lot, certainly since I've been making things. But I think there's always a very deep connection to all parts of that kind of ceramic tradition. And certainly with my own work, that's something that's very much a part of the way that I think I'm maybe reacting to things that have gone before. Or I think as well, anyone that works with clay is kind of really sort of deeply involved with that as a material and the kind of language that that opens up to you. And although the outcomes might be very different, then I think there is something that maybe binds us all together through that kind of material and the processes you have to go through to work with it.
Who else do we see? Who are we going to see at Form in Miami?
So a lot of ceramics. We focused the show specifically on that material, though we have a couple of other makers working in other materials. So, for example, a couple of fairly recent graduates from the Royal College, Katie Sprague, who also combines animation with very, very delicate clay sculptures and installations. Lauren Naumann, who creates very fine cage-like vessels that take form in the kiln. Her results are always slightly unpredictable, which speaks to your point about the
all ceramics are, aren't well, they? All pottery is.
Yeah. Indeed. And then James Rigler, another ceramist whose work again references ornamentation and antiques and ruins. So we've seen a lot of this trend of the reference to, you know, centuries old traditions in ceramics resurfacing in a new way in contemporary practice. And then we've got Charlotte Kingsnorth, who makes these extraordinary biomorphic upholstered chairs and sofas that look like bodies in their own right. And then the furniture maker Sebastian Cox, who works with traditional British hardwoods and coppice timbers. And
so you've run the gamut of materials and of process and of the final result, I suppose, there in lots of ways.
We have, but we're looking to tell a coherent story of materiality. So those works, we always, for our opportunities, we get a huge number of applications because people are really hungry to take their work internationally. So it's our job to select what's going to work on that stage, but also create a coherent selection so that the works complement each other.
We talked just before we came on air, you know, that you're a body that's partly public funded. And there seems to be a little bit of an interesting pull on two sides for the world of craft. There are the people who say craft should be about making cutlery in Sheffield, and it should be about our industrial heritage. And, you know, if we're going to talk about the world of clay and pottery, it should be how can we revive the potteries, for example. And on the other side, we have this extraordinary experimental work which probably nudges into the world of the Arts Council almost. Is that a kind of debate within the organisation? You know, do we have to look after both sides of this argument, or we have a very different remit that's nothing to do with those Yeah, mm-hmm. Do your tendrils run in both directions?
Our tendrils do run. It's our job to champion making in all its guises. And if we think about a young person at school or indeed a student studying textiles or studying, let's say, metalsmithing or glassmaking, we don't know what direction their career might go in. It might be that they go into industrial production and work for a huge manufacturer. It might be that they follow a fine art route. It might be that they set up their own studio making everyday products. But really what's at the heart of our mission is about making in all its guises.
And Phoebe, for you, when you realised you had this, you know, affinity for clay and for what it can do, did you know the kind of direction that you would go in? Were your tutors nudging you in saying, actually, you should be more of a kind of traditional maker and make pots and things? Or did you immediately realise there was this artistic direction? We should say for people, I saw some of the things you've made incredibly intricate. So this idea that they then wash away flowers and garlands and extraordinary pieces. Again, we come back to this notion that you've embraced the ephemeral bit of it, that it's here to be seen and then gone. But did you get pushed ever in a maker's direction of making pots and pans and things?
No, I mean, I think in terms of when I was studying, like I initially did a BA at Brighton, which was a mixed materials course, and then did an MA in ceramics after that at the Royal College. And I think both of those courses were very broad in terms of, again, you were kind of in a group of people interested in materials, but that went in very different directions. So some people were making tableware and others were very much more design, and it kind of, encompassed all those different things that the Crafts Council supports, I guess. There certainly wasn't any pressure to, I didn't feel like in education there wasn't a pressure to go one way or the other, but I think it was a lot about trying to find your own path through that. And certainly for me, the way that I initially began making more ephemeral work was kind of quite a practical solution after I graduated and had no money, and it was a way of continuing to make the things that I was really interested in, but reducing the cost of needing a studio or, firing things so I could keep recycling the same clay. And so, yeah, in one way, it was a very kind of practical thing. It's like, okay, if I want to keep doing this, then what am I willing to compromise on? And absolutely, what will I kind of not give up? And yeah.
And just finally, Annie, how important is being able to talk about it? I suppose this is obviously Phoebe's bearing us out here, that she's obviously good at talking about her practice and all the rest of it. But is that still very much an important part of it, despite the fact that the Crafts Council will be a mouthpiece for makers and artists and craftspeople? Is being able to being able to have a bit of an elevator pitch for each thing, especially at something like Miami, which is such a busy week for collectors, for journalists and all the rest of it. Artists themselves sometimes even turn up and talk about their stuff. Is talking about it, being able to talk the talk, an important part?
Definitely. What people are interested in are the stories behind the objects. You spoke earlier about how things are made, but also where they come from, both in terms of quite literally physical place, but also where they come from in terms of tradition and subversion of tradition. And the more an artist or a maker can communicate that, the better, because that's what attracts people to those works.
Beautiful stuff. It's so lovely to meet you both and talk us through this show and also your practice. Phoebe Cummings, a maker, and Annie Warburton from the Crafts Council. Thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And Phoebe's work, along with many other talents, will be showing at Miami's Form Fair from the 6th to the 10th of December as part of Miami Art Week. You are tuned in to The Weekly.
Time for some music. This is from Welsh-born London synth popper Kelly Lee Owens. And it's Spaces.
That was Spaces by Kelly Lee Owens on Small Town Supersound Records, and you are tuned in to the Monocle Weekly.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulet and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at McGrory House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymn book paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brûlé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
Libreria Bookshop in East London has been praised for its beautifully designed store, knowledgeable staff and engaging events. Sounds like Monocle. Well, the latest of which is an all-nighter taking place at Libreria on Saturday the 16th of December, where they'll be celebrating some of the darker tales found in great literature.
There'll be readings ranging from contemporary author Mark Forsyth recounting tales from his book A Short History of Drunkenness to stories by the Brothers Grimm, music and much more. Recently, Libreria's Paddy Butler sat down with Monocle's Tom Hall to discuss how to create ideas that inspire new readers and whether gatherings in bookshops at night are something he's seen anywhere else.
I think there is a tradition across Europe, yeah, for sure, late night book hunting, have a glass of wine and a beer, and we've tried to do that as well. Thursday, Fridays and Saturdays, we're open till 9. Beer and browse, come down and you know, have events there like DJs or readings on those evenings. But I think it's less of a thing in the UK where you have all night entertainment in a bookshop. And yeah, why not celebrate that? And celebrate it when, you know, we've got 24-hour overground. So yeah, I think that's... At the outset, we wanted to do more and more of these. And we did do one in the first summer that we opened. But yeah, we're going to revisit it.
I mean, we'll come on to the sort of the slightly more serious side, the opening up of the nighttime economy, I guess, by things like trains running later. We have these overground trains that we're celebrating coming into sort of 24-hour use. Let's talk about the nighttime itself, because I've been to a few events. I went to like an all-night gig with loads and loads of bands last summer, and that there is a strange thing that happens to people's sort of sensibility. There's a strange thing about trying to sort of reach the dawn, isn't there? I mean, how is that going to operate in a bookshop? I'm curious about how this is going to be. Is this just going to be a party?
I think it's a bit of both, you know. I mean, we're going to have traditional folk music. We're going to have DJs. But, you know, we're in keeping with a bookshop, we'll have readings from Magdalena Morrissey. She's going to read from the Brothers Grimm, Hansel and Gretel. They're actually recording a soundscape to go with that. And then myself and a friend of mine, Dr. Brian Murray from King's at 2 a.m., we're going to read from James Joyce's Ulysses, the Ithaca section of Ulysses, which is kind of questions and answers. So time-wise, we're going to try and keep to that. It's quite a funny episode when you read it. And I think it might be funnier as well when, you know, after a couple of drinks, we're reading it on stage. But I think it's a bit of both. It crosses over between the two, you know, i.e., let's have a party, let's embrace nightlife in London. But also, you know, literary inflected, I suppose, is the best way to put it. And
literary inflected nightlife.
This is new. Yeah, I suppose. I guess it will be new at 3 o'clock in the morning for sure, definitely.
I'm also intrigued by a reading that's going to be going on by the author Mark Forsyth from his book, A Short History of Drunkenness. That's a fantastic title. I hadn't come across that.
Yeah.
Tell me about that book and what that might involve.
Well, I guess he's looking at it from, you know, the history in terms of, in literary terms, but...
It's not just going to be a history of the last few hours.
Yeah, well, I think it might set the tone, all right, because I think he's going to read early on, but I think it's across, you know, how we enjoy ourselves, how we kind of psychologically release, you know, I mean, it goes back millennia, doesn't it? Like, you know, that kind of the whole idea of relaxing and getting away from the reality of life. And I suppose there's a great section in Jonathan Mead's Magnetic North where he is actually discussing that, you know, his famous documentary, BBC documentary. And inebriation is part of, you know, especially us in the north, in the cold climes, as it is now. I think that's one way of us, you know, one way for us to deal with the extremes of our environment and our culture. And, it, you know, it's no different, you know, from back in Roman times or, you know, straight up, right up to our times or even before Roman times. I mean, it's long with us.
One thing that strikes me when I walk into, especially a bookshop that isn't huge, I'm always amazed that, because we have the internet out there, we can click on Amazon if we want and we can technically get anything we want, but I'm always amazed that I don't walk in there and just think to myself, oh well, the thing I want isn't here. So yeah, like there's always something else to keep you interested, and that must come through having a really good curatorial eye and being able to organize shops and book the stock that perhaps if it's not actually physically there is definitely something else there which you didn't even know that you were keen to read. Tell me how you go about sort of arranging a shop like that.
To be honest, it starts with the research, and it's kind of like if you're a good chef, you know, they always say, you know, it's sourcing good product. And I think if there is some sort of a parallel, it's research, it's reading your journals, it's reading books, it's communicating with people, and it's having discussions. And I think that's what the bookshop, in essence, is able to do, as opposed to the online shopping experience. You know, you come down to Liberia to talk to us about books. That then feeds back into the curation of books on the shelf. From the start, it has been, we've kind of tried to reimagine what a bookshop can be in terms of our thematic shelving, fiction beside nonfiction, and different, under different headings like utopia, time and space, that sort of thing. So to try and mix it up curatorially. As I said, our utopia shelf is a wonderful addition. I think, when did we put it together? Maybe six, seven months ago. And within that, like, you know, utopia, what does it inspire? You know, it inspires so many things. And there are no hard and fast rules. You can have, you know, within that, Richard Rogers beside Jean-Jacques Rousseau's A Social Contract. The book in itself, there are two, you know, there's architecture beside 18th century, you know, philosopher of enlightenment talking about how the individual is committed to the state. You know, there's two different utopias there, isn't there? Like, you know, and that's quite a nice little creative collision, and the collision of two philosophies, essentially, you know. The example I like to cite is Helen Castor's biographical study of Joan of Arc beside Angela Carter, you know. So you've got this Angela Carter, incredible fiction author, phantasmagoria, whatever you want to call it, because it's so rich, there's so many things, besides this incredible study of this incredible figure that we don't know a huge amount about, but we know was an inspiring figure. So I think curating is kind of like an argument, you know, it's an argument. You either decide to go with convention and the argument has less impact, whereas if, you know, if you are pushing things a little bit and you're putting things beside each other which will kind of argue or fight, whatever way you want to think about it, I think once you stop arguing with the past, or you stop arguing with convention or how you perceive or what you perceive as convention, then I think then it's kind of less inspiring, I think. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. Really boring administrative question here. Yeah. Have you got the shift patterns worked out? Because someone might have a really, really tired Sunday if they're doing the all-nighter and then working Sunday too. That can't happen, can
it? Well, it is a good question, actually. But our second home co-founder, Rohan, he's going to man the shit with me until 6 a.m. And I think, we'll get somebody else in for the Sunday shift, because I think I'll be falling asleep at the wheel, you know?
But in a very real sense as well, you are sort of, you're tying this event loosely to the overjoying sensation of East London's overground becoming 24 hours, which follows some of the underground trains which have done that earlier. Yeah. I mean, it could be a slightly tenuous link, but I mean, does that sense of the nighttime economy, I mean, does that really play into something like a bookshop full time, or is it more something that you can sort of pick and choose for events and just utilise to your liking? I mean, I can't imagine that bookshopping is really a sort of 2am pursuit, but maybe I'm incorrect. Maybe you can tell me more.
I think both myself and Rohan, I think we want to change that attitude. I mean, there should be a nightlife for insomniacs, no?
Yeah, very true, very true. Well, that's technically, that could be the day life.
I'm
getting mixed up in the semantics of it.
Me too, actually. I think there should be a kind of more cultural element. Not that nightclubs aren't cultural. I love nightclubs, love music, and I love London nightlife because people are great and the scenes are great and there's so much to do. But I think things like Art Night London and, you know, museums opening late, if we can do it and if we can kind of push things in that direction where it's opened up, why not like have Liberia open 24 hours every weekend? You know, if that, myself and Rohan, we'd love to be able to do that, you know, and to provide events. And it's not beyond the realms of possibility. If we do have those transport links opened up, and because London is hungry for that, it's vibrant. You have to be careful when you undertake these sort of things. You know, you go to Berlin and it is that way every weekend. Okay, or Portugal, you know, where you have bookshops open, you know, really, really late. So, yeah, I guess, you know, if we can, why not? You know, I think, why should people have to go to a nightclub? You know, they should have the choice whether they want to sit and read. It's really heartening, you know, on a Friday and a Saturday night when I'm working at Liberia, like the diversity of, you know, custom that comes through the doors, the different people, it's just so joyful. And they come in and they spend like a couple of hours, buy a couple of books and just chill out. And Liberia kind of offers them that place to do that.
We encourage everyone to head down to the store on the 16th of December, and luckily you can get the train home as well.
Yeah, exactly.
That was Paddy Butler from London's Libreria Bookshop speaking to Monocle's Tom Hall, and the all-nighter at Libreria takes place on Saturday the 16th of December. We do recommend you head down.
Well, Catalonia has not been far from the news headlines over the past couple of months. The proudly independent region has been enduring a struggle for independence from Spain or not, and its future is certainly still far from certain.
Though we often hear about its famously vibrant cultural history, epitomised by art the likes of Juan Miró and Salvador Dalí, and the incomparable architecture of Antoni Gaudí, the region's food culture is less well known. José Pizarro, the chef and restaurateur, is looking to change this, though, of course. And his new book, Catalonia, Recipes from Barcelona and Beyond, collects some of his favourite dishes from the region. And by luck, he's in the studio with us today. José, welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much. So happy to be here.
So your book is a beautiful thing, a kind of Miro-esque cover on it as well. We've got all bases covered there. It seems to be a lot about place as it is about cookery. Mm-hmm. Tell us about your idea of putting food together with the place that it's from.
For me, the most important thing when I'm writing a book is to go to the area and research for very old recipes, but at the same time to meet new people there. You have to go there and meet the real people. And you just sit or be next to them, cooking with them, having a glass of wine, and that for me is heaven. And we call research.
I know. It's a good job, this research, isn't
it? It's a very good job indeed, I have to say.
And do you know where that research trip, where it was going to sort of start, where it was going to end? I know the book is called Barcelona and Beyond. Is that what you did? You kind of went up country from Barcelona, north up to Havana.
I went north to Costa Brava, and then I thought I was going to spend like 2 or 3 days there. I spent more than a week, and then just went back down to Barcelona, and then Delta del Ebro, that is near to Valencia. I found so incredible old recipes and just delicious. It's really good.
You run restaurants here in London, but for the people who come to your restaurants and people thinking about Spanish food, I guess the first step is to think that many of the things we think of being typically Spanish are actually very regional dishes. You know, so paella isn't exactly a dish that you would find all over Spain. Was part of this book breaking down people's, you know, perceptions of what Spanish food is and honing in on one region to say, look, it is very regional and this is something special that happens here.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Spain is not just about paella, patatas bravas and sangria. It's more than that. All of them very good if they make it make properly. But Catalonia is very specific. They have things called mar y montaña. It's mountain and the sea. And they mix seafood and meat together. The mix.
There's an amazing photograph in here of the calamari with meat.
Yeah, it's
and which you wouldn't think of if you were an English chef. It's not the first thing that would come to mind, but it looks incredible. And the taste
It's just stunning. The history say that was a mermaid full in love of a shipper that coming from the sea and the mountain, and they just fall in love and bring food together. That's lovely. What's it all about?
A little bit of poetry there, a bit of meat.
I don't know, it's true, it's not, but the flavours coming from the meatballs and cuttlefish is really, really, really good.
And tell us, because this is as we put in our preface, Catalonia itself has a very interesting history, an independent history, mm-hmm. all of that. How much history is bound up in these recipes? Because we taste history in our food more readily than we read it in a book most of the time. How old are these old recipes?
They are not very old. I will say maybe a couple of hundred, some of them. Mm. But you can see quite a lot of pasta there. And you say, wow, pasta, what is pasta quite popular in Catalonia. The Catalonian and the King of Aragon were in Italy, and they bring not just the dolce vita, they bring the pasta as well. No? but yeah, it's all about as well recipes done from my friends, and nothing have to be with Catalonia. Yes, they are just living in there, and they just passing to me. No. It's all about that. It's all about just not just the old recipes from Catalonia or traditional. It's about my friend recipes or just people gave me recipes or my recipes, my ideas with ingredients that I saw in the area.
Now, as Rob said, food is identity, and we've had a very kind of extraordinary year in Catalonia. This book comes out. Can it be separated from all of that discussion, or are you finding your book caught up in that debate about what is Spanish and what is not Spanish, what it means to be together and what it means to be apart?
Yes, I launched the book a bit more than a month ago in my restaurant in Pizarro, and I have the government from Catalonia and the government from Madrid together around the same route. I have to say, food bring people together. Yeah. And that evening was a lovely evening and everyone enjoyed. And this book is just came, I have to say, I have to give big thank you to Catalonia and Madrid, to Barcelona, Madrid, or whatever you want to say, no? Because definitely it's talking a lot about Catalonia.
Because you're from Extremadura, that's where you were born, which is very farming, one of the poorer parts of Spain. But when you go to somewhere like Barcelona and see its food culture from your background in Extremadura, does it feel other? Does it feel a little bit foreign to you? Or do you in your mind think of Spanish food collectively?
The thing for me is Spanish food is all about simplicity. It's all about that quality. It's all about great ingredients putting together. Extremadura was still a little bit behind Catalonia, of course. But for us, it's that simplicity. It's that ingredient that make everything. Of course, we have now so many great chefs in Spain. Their creativity is unbelievable. But for me, when I'm thinking about Catalan, Extremadura, or Galician food, or Andalusian food, I'm just thinking about these people being eating incredible recipes or eating great ingredients for many, 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 many years. That is Spanish food. And for me, when I came here to London, it's what I wanted to show to my friend, to my client, my customer, that in Spain we have great ingredients that 19 years ago, people didn't know much about. Incredible olive oil, pimentón, that is the Spanish paprika, so many saffrons and incredible things.
What's it like running restaurants and then making a book of recipes? They're quite different things to me. Presumably, if you're planning the menu for the next couple of months in José and Pizarro and on Bermondsey Street here in London, and then you're trying to put down what you like about a region and about the recipes that you've got from it. They're two quite separate things. One is about cooking and one is about following a recipe. How do you glue those two worlds together?
I think go very well together, because my style of cooking is just that simplicity. I just see now those razor clams with jamon.
Because obviously on the menu now. In a kitchen, you just go, I've bought these in, these are from Bishopsgate, you know, these are absolutely fresh as a daisy, just get on and cook them. Whereas you can't say that to the man on the street who's going to buy your book. How do you translate, what have you found is the best way of translating your skill into these recipes?
If you follow the recipes, you will get exactly the same thing.
Wow. I promise you. I think that sounds like a solid goal guarantee, Andrew.
Seriously, seriously, you know, it's...
Well, it's beautifully shot. The book, we should tell listeners that the book is a mix of photography of place and of the landscape and the people that you'll see, and it's printed on a beautiful mat stock, and then the food looks incredible, and it is shot, as you say, in a kind of outdoors, rustic-y, kind of simple way that puts the focus on all the ingredients.
But so some of those recipes or some of those pictures are the same than I had in the house. Or in the restaurant.
So these are kind of like reference pictures.
It's not like I've been in a studio. Some of them, of course, are studio pictures, but some of them is just real picture.
I like some of the imperfections from the house, from that
woman that was from Andalusia and now is living in Catalonia, and she just loved to show me the Catalonia cuisine with a big Andalusian influence.
And Jose, tell us a little bit about your life. I've read in previous interviews that there was a moment when you were wondering about being a dentist or a chef.
I finished dentist technician.
Okay.
I finished. And I had like a 3-4 month gap. And as you can see me, I'm quite, you know, I have to be always doing something. And I was waiting for a job and I started doing a cookery course. I'm going to say, okay, I'm not going to waste my time. And 23 years after, I never went to Seville. Nothing to do anymore with tooth. And now I just...
Well, I think maybe you have been a bit oral focused ever since. But tell me, that moment when you did the course, did you know that you were a good cook? Were you'd always been somebody helping your family in the kitchen? Or
not at all, because I'm from a very, very little village, from a farm. And when you are a child in a little village, no iPad, no iPhone, anything to do. The only thing that you can do is helping your dad or be a naughty boy. As you can imagine, I was more in the second one than the first one. And nothing, never, ever in my life, I was allowed to go inside the kitchen. My mom was like, you go away now. And my grandmother neither. But I grew up with all those smells, with the best ingredients that you can get. That sounds stupid, but when you are a little and you smell a tomato in summer, very early in the morning, that smell is something that will be with you forever. That milk, you know, straight from the cow, that flavors, I think, were inside of me all my life. And it was a point when I start cooking, everything made sense to me, you know? The smell, the flavors. I say, wow. And I can make very happy people with if I put everything together. And that happens. I start cooking and I never will go back to anything related to
dentistry.
Sit down in front of, in a desk. Yeah. No. And I love people. I love entertaining, and my restaurants are like... Like I always say, like my house, you know? You make money from them. Very important, but...
Yeah. What about, is there something, as we talked before, both Andrew and I have alluded to the fact that there is the food and identity are impossible to remove from each other.
Definitely
is there
not.
A dish that you remember from childhood that maybe is in this book, or is something that is a staple in your restaurant, Jose?
Always, it's not in this book, but it's something that... is with me and will be always, is the smell of the churros.
Mm.
You know, my mom, she was
so
always
good.
Helping my dad. You know, they lived for 60 years together. And that's always we have that food. Always for me, not every day churros, because sometimes it was not very, a bit naughty, and my mom was like, not churros.
Well, if
today.
You're a bad boy, then I can't imagine.
But always that smell, you know, the bread, churros, and another one is a toast with chocolate, salt, and pepper. That was from my grandmother. Is here Nutella. In Spain was nocilla. The same thing, no? That was like a very special thing. And of course, in the book, it's not exactly like that. Not in this book, in another one, but yeah.
You hinted that over the last two decades, the British people's relationship with food, as in many cities around the world, has improved, and the way that ingredients travel has improved. For you, doing these kinds of recipes in London, how easy is it to get, the things you want? You talk about, even something as humble as a tomato. I'm well aware when you go to Spain or something and you pick up a tomato, it's probably not been in a refrigerated truck for like 3 weeks or something. You pick up a fruit that's still warm. Mm-hmm. Even getting the basic stuff that you need for your recipes, is it easier today in London?
It's the same than even in Spain, I have to say.
Okay.
If I want anything special, normally don't do. But if you are coming to me, I say, I really
but if you want the olive
this,
oil, for example.
The olive oil is easy and everything. But for example, if you want that specific fish, if you tell me today before 12, it's going to be in my restaurant tomorrow at 9 in the morning.
Yeah, because even razor clams, they're tough
anything.
Guys to get hold of.
Anything. Razor clams is very underrated thing, but they are so yummy.
So good, yeah.
So sweet. You really have that mix between the sweetness, the sea, and it's just something very, very special.
Wow. I thought I was going to get through the whole interview without slavering under the microphone cover, but I haven't managed it.
And what's next for you? You want to grow? I know that London is super expensive. Lots of things, we won't go into the Brexit debate, but lots of things on hold as people wonder what's going to happen with crowds coming and going. Are you thinking more restaurants, more books?
Definitely, my publisher, they want more books. Will I have to do is something that is in my heart. A book about Extremadura, my region. I want to do with my mum. Mummy is going to be the co-author. And it's something.
You're allowed in the kitchen this time.
Definitely. Yeah. Now she trusts me. My methods sometimes are a bit different, and my time of cooking are a bit different than her. But she's allowed me. I want to open another restaurant. I have a very good team behind me. Lovely people that really want to grow as well, because when I grow, it's not just myself, it's the team behind me, my family, it's happening.
That's on the horizon.
Yeah.
Power to you, Jose. Listen, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Jose Pizarro is the author of Catalonia, Recipes from Barcelona and Beyond. Dare we say it, just out in time for Christmas? I think we have.
The very perfect gift.
Jose, thank you very much.
Thank you. That was lovely. Cheers. Thank you.
Four-three-nine, Andrew, of the Monocle Weekly, down.
Well, okay. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Tasha Kleeman, and our studio managers were Cassie Galpin and Christy Evans.
And the Monocle Weekly will be back same time, same place, possibly different personnel, but for the time being, from me, Robert Bounds.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.